This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to the part of the Financial Sense News Hour, which we call the big picture, in which we try to make some sense of all of the dots that are floating around out there. Lots of information in today's world, not necessarily a lot of comprehension of that information. And indeed, here on the program, Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. We spend a lot of time discussing the Federal Reserve, and there is good reason for that. Obviously, their monetary policy shapes what the economy is going to do. And 11 of the 12 recessions that we have bounced through since World War II were preceded by Federal Reserve rate hikes. Recessions then lead to bear markets in stocks. And right now, we find ourselves in the middle of a rate-raising cycle, and the Fed indicates that it's going to raise some more, and we have a flattening yield curve. So now the question is, will it revert and be followed by a recession and then a bear market in stocks? You know, what we try to do here on the program, as far as our technicians are concerned, we get different ones on for different perspectives, and usually you can figure out what's going on if you just listen to what everybody's saying. But Tom McClellan thinks that we're in a bear market until August, while today's guest, today's technician, John Kosar, thinks if the S&P could get up to 2750 and hold, the market could rise to 3,000 and another record. So here's the big issue, because if you're an investor, this is what you want to know. How do you know when you're approaching a peak so you can take whatever new actions are required to deal with the changes in the market?
I want to begin our big picture today with an article that I recently read in Bloomberg Markets, and it was written by Cameron Criss, I think is the name, C-R-I-S-E, and it's called, Are There Indicators That Can Flag Market Tops or Bottoms? And it's definitely worth reading. You can probably find it in your local Barnes & Noble bookstore, but he basically wanted to take a look at, are there things out there that people follow technically as we have every single week. We always have a technician on the program. They all look at, they all have favorite indicators. I always am amazed that you can get several technicians look at a chart and they all can see something a little different. And it just comes from their own perspective. But it's definitely worth an article of, just go and read it. Because what he did is he took a look at four major indicators that are used in the market. And he looked at several markets. He looked at our S&P, the NASDAQ, the Nikkei, the DAX, the London FTSE, the Euro Stock Index, and the Shanghai Composite. And he wanted to see, were there clear signs if you were approaching a market bottom or a market top? In other words, kind of looking for the holy grail. Is there a list or a group of things that if you follow these things, you can pick the market top or you can pick the market bottom? So it is really helpful, especially when you're managing risk and you want to take advantage or either, get out as you get close to a market top because nobody wants to go through a bear market, or take advantage of a market bottom. I mean, how many people bought in March of 2009 when the S&P got down to 666? Remember what the news was like? You know, everything was going to hell in a handbasket. Government policies didn't seem to be working. No matter what the Fed did, it wasn't working. Companies, banks were just, the financials were plunging as they had to mark down their loans. They were losing money. And it looked like the whole system was going to unravel. Well, it changed. It flipped. And here we are almost 10 years later, and look where the market's come. We're approaching closer to 2700 than we are a little over 600. So what I want to talk about is the things that he used in his study, because I think it's worth mentioning. He looked at four basic indicators. Price divergence. And that is when something begins to diverge either at a top or bottom, indicating that there's a trend change. Trading volume. And then price rejection and volatility.
Just out of curiosity, Jim, why those four?
You know, these are main indicators that a lot of technicians use, whether they're looking at RSI, they're looking at volume. Volume needs to confirm either moves up or down in a trend change. And so these are widely followed in the industry. And the first indicator he looked at was price divergence. in what he was talking about, the market always goes to extremes on the upside and the downside. And when it reaches an extreme, either in, let's say, a market top or a market bottom, when prices reach these extremes, you usually start to see if they're peaking or troughing. Divergences are often formed at these tops and bottoms. And he used a momentum indicator, which a lot of you that follow technical analysis are very familiar with. It's called RSI, Relative Strength Indicator, 14-day. This indicator compares the size of the up moves with that of the down moves during a specific period. And you're looking for extremes, either on the high side or on the bottom. And each market peak or trough tends to show some sort of what we call negative divergence in momentum. Let's say the stock market is going up, but all of a sudden the indicators are not showing or confirming that trend. That is telling you something is happening below the surface. It could be distribution. The smart money is unloading their positions to the public as the market rises to record levels. The smart money figures, you know what, we're headed for a bear market. I'm taking my profits. And so even though you're hitting new highs, there isn't a lot of energy behind the move. And that's really what momentum is, either on the upside or the downside. So usually the RSI leadings, whether lower on the day of the market top or in prior days, they are higher during a market bottom. And what that might indicate is when you hit a market bottom, smart money, something is changing. It's coming back into the market. And we'll talk about some of these other indicators. But divergences alert you that something is about ready to change. It isn't bulletproof. In other words, stocks can still head higher. When you start to see these divergences, that doesn't mean you've hit the top or you hit the bottom. What it does alert you to is there is an approaching trend change. It may be temporary or it may be a major trend change. For example, moving from a bear market to a bull market or a bull market to a bear market.
Okay, so what were some of the other ones and their relevance in terms of finding a peak in the market?
One of the second ones he used is volume, and volume usually gets thin and recedes close to market tops. In other words, there are fewer and fewer stocks that are leading the charge. As you get towards the peak of a market, it's only the generals that are left. And we often use the analogy like a tree that heads into autumn. You start to see a few leaves start to fall. You start seeing the equivalent in stocks is a few stocks hit their peak. Then all of a sudden, more stocks are peaking out and rolling over until eventually the tree is bare. And this is usually what happens. And volume is a key in that regard. Anytime like you come out of a correction as we did in February, you want to see volume behind a trend because it tells you that it's strong. You want to see momentum. You want to see energy behind the move, whether it's up or down. And if you think about what drives this, it's the human emotions of fear and greed. Think of the fear that was prevalent towards the end of January and the first week of February, where in 6 days, the market lost 12%. Or think of the euphoria that was in place the first couple of weeks of January, where it seemed like nonstop for almost 18 months. I call it the escalator ride, where stocks kept going up. It didn't matter what was going on in the markets, in the world, or the economy, geopolitically, nothing stopped the market. We didn't get anything more than a 2% correction. And then all of a sudden, money started to pour into the market because people are saying, oh my goodness, the market's up double digits. I want to get in on it. And that is reflected, whether it's fear or greed, is reflected in the momentum you see in the market. And that usually shows up in the way of volume. You can see this on the chart, for example. If you have a chart program, go back to the beginning of 2009, and you can see volume picking up as the S&P kept dropping and dropping. More volume came into the market, and there's almost this crescendo of selling pressure that comes into the market. And you can see this on March 9th, 2009, when the S&P bottomed at that infamous 666. And you can also see this in previous months, and you can see it also as we were approaching the market peak in August, September, and October. in 2007. So this is a very important indicator if you really want confirmation of a trend, either up or down. I remember a number of years ago, I was interviewing John Murphy, a very well-known technician, and he's written quite extensively. A lot of his books were used in the CMT program, and I love his books on intermarket analysis. He was a pioneer in that field. And I was asking him, I said, you've been a technician for well over 40 years. You know, are there particular indicators that you like to use that give you a clue on the market? And he said, you know, Jim, the older I get, the simpler it gets. I've gotten almost to the point, if I can draw a straight line, that's all I follow. And is the straight line going up or is the straight line going down? It gets that simple. But, you know, the one thing that whether you're looking at a straight line or a trend, you always want to see volume confirm that. Now, I want to get to the third one because this is important and we have a good lesson to learn from it. And we saw it in January and February this year, and that is volatility. Now, if you think of volatility, it's muted at market tops. And when I say muted, you know, everything gets complacent. Volatility is down. Nobody is expecting any disruption in the markets. Think back to the beginning of this year when the stock market was going up every single month ever since the November 8th elections in 2016. And the VIX index, which expresses this volatility, they call it the fear index, had gotten down to 9 in the first week of January, a record low. And then, of course, we got that flip on the unemployment report on that Friday, January 26th, and the VIX went from a low of 9 all the way to 50 in a period of 6 days, and it spiked up as fear came into the market. So once again, when you think of this volatility, think of human emotions. Think of fear, think of greed. As the VIX was spiking, so was the volume that was going along with it as investors panicked and sold out as the volatility trade blew up. And that's what happened in January. There was this trend that was in place. There were a lot of leverage funds that were shorting volatility. It seemed like an easy way to make money. It had worked for nearly 2 years. People were making a fortune in it, but they were leveraged trades in a period of weeks, a period of a week, several of these large funds lost 80 to 90% of their value, which is one of the dangers when you deal in leverage, is it can amplify your gains on the way up, but it can wipe you out on the way down.
And the final indicator.
The final indicator was price rejection, and there is very little evidence, according to Chris, that bottoms form when stocks make a new low or when they close higher on the day, and then all of a sudden they change. So basically, you know, this was probably the least predictable one of the four that he looked at, but technicians are always looking for that. They're looking for that subtle change either at a top or at a bottom. They're looking for that inflection point that is telling them early this thing or this trend in place is about to change. And the trouble with all of these, depending on certain times of the market in different markets, there are a couple of these that really stand out and you say, boy, that was a clear warning or a clear opportunity for something that, you know, we had hit bottom or we had hit the top.
You know, the impression I'm getting here is that none of what you're saying is really conclusive. You know, you can't just say, well, this in one indicator over here, this is the one you really want to watch, because when this goes over this point, then, you know, it's time to make a change in investment. I don't think you can really say that.
And that's, you know, one of the drawbacks to technical analysis. It can give you a trend. I mean, that's what technicians want to do. They want to spot a trend and they're looking for inflection points. And unfortunately, every single market, there isn't a holy grail. In fact, Chris's own conclusions is that when it comes to market extremes, history clearly doesn't repeat, when at best, it probably only rhymes. And there are just too many instances where the market behavior diverges from the norm, is quite honestly, as we're seeing right now. I mean, take a look at, we were in this clear trend from the election of 2016 all the way up to the final week in January. And since that correction in January, what have we been doing? We've been going back and forth, rallying up only to rally down. And as many technicians have suggested here, we're probably going through a time consolidation because there are a lot of things that are out there that are still favorable. Companies are reporting record earnings. The economy is picking up steam, at least here in the U.S. It's starting to slow down internationally. So we're not at that point, at least I don't think we're at that point, as we'll pick up this topic in the next segment of the big picture, where interest rates start to choke off the economic growth and head us into a recession. So his conclusions are there is no holy grail of calling market tops and bottoms.
Well, Jim, obviously you've said quite a few times that you've got your own indicators as well. So your team, what do you do to determine tops and bottoms?
You know, we use four fundamental models that we use to give us a sort of a sense of what's happening in the markets and also happening in the economy. And then we have one, what I call a set of technical indicators to form our conclusions. Where are we in a market topping process or in a market bottom process? And like Chris's study, John, they aren't perfect in that we may be out of the market a bit early, or we may be back in the market a little bit late. But what we're trying to do here is really capture most of the upside in the market and avoid the bulk of the damage in the downside. And what we've done is we've broken them up into two groups. One has to do with the Fed itself in financial stress in the market, because usually when you see these recessions, you see some kind of financial crisis that emerges, as we did in 2007 with Bear Stearns and then eventually with Lehman. So the first model that we use is what we call the Fed monetary model. And that really is trying to give us a sense or feeling, is monetary policy too tight or is it still too loose? And why that's important is if you look at the Fed announced it was going to change its monetary policy in May of 2013, and that was the taper tantrum. It began to cut back its quantitative easing program beginning in 2014. It completed it by 2015. So if you look at this, what we started in 2014, here we are in 2018. This has been a four-year process. It took them almost 2 years to phase out the tapering of quantitative easing. In 2 years, it only raised interest rates once. It raised it in December of 2015, December of 2016, because it wasn't sure. What were the things that we were hearing at the time? They were data dependent. And the economic data was very conflicting. It would look strong, and then all of a sudden the economy would weaken, or we would have a financial hiccup as we did in 2015, and the Fed would back off. The same thing happened in 2016, which was an election year. The Fed only went once, even though at the beginning of the year they were predicting two or three rate hikes. It was only last year that the Fed actually raised interest rates three times, and it looks like maybe three or possibly four this time. Our monetary model right now is still saying we're in a loose monetary environment, so that is still favorable for stocks. When it starts to go tight and it tells us that the Fed is in a tight mode, the second thing that we look at is our financial stress indicator. And that is really judging the stress in the financial system. And what this follows is the spread between corporate bonds and quality bonds. In other words, AAA to, let's say, junk bonds. And right now, that spread is very tight. It is narrowed. When credit spreads or financial stress starts to emerge, and this is one of the reasons why we say that the bond guys are the smartest guys on the street, you want to follow the bond market. When spreads begin to widen, that tells you there's trouble out there in the financial sector, and sooner or later, you're going to see somebody blow up, somebody go bankrupt, somebody go under. And those two together make one sort of macro indicator. The two go hand in hand, because when the Fed really starts to get tight, the financial stress indicator will begin to rise, and it's not perfect. For example, this happened in 2011. The monetary indicator was loose. However, the financial stress indicator heightened, credit spreads blew out. It looked like we were heading into a recession. You remember what was happening in 2011? The Arab Spring, oil prices hit like $110 a barrel. The U.S. debt got downgraded in September. And then in the fall, the pig crisis in Europe, where bond spreads blew out. Greek yields got up to 30%. You saw Italy, Spain, and Portugal with bond yields of 8, 10, and 12 hard to believe they're down to 2 today and negative on the short end. So it's, once again, this isn't perfect, but it alerts you to something is changing, as it did in 2011. And it also happened again in the fall of 2015 going into 2016. And where that was useful is as credit spreads widened over fears over inflation, fears over China, all kinds of things were going in. Credit spreads just blew out, and it was a great opportunity, at least for us and our clients. We were able to go in as these bond funds got liquidations from their shareholders. These bond mutual funds had to go into the market and dump their bonds at steep discounts. I can remember buying an oil company bond for 1 year. It had a 5% coupon and a discount to market of 5%. So in 1 year, we were able to lock in a 10% return. So this is why, or that's how we use it. So these two, monetary and Fed tightening, go hand in hand.
What about your LEIs, Jim? I mean, leading economic indicators. We talk about them a lot here on the show, and you've got your own, and then there are the ones that other people watch.
The other indicators are economic driven. There are LEI index, and we follow 19 of them, and then we follow about 5 or 6 international. And then we also have what is called an anticipatory index that kind of tells us that there's something changing in the LEIs. And then second is our recession index. The two are related. As the LEI index begins to roll over, and you see this in the public too as well, our recession index starts to rise. And the danger point is when it gets to 20. Now, it got to 20, actually, I think it was about 21 in the summer of 2011. And so that prompted us to go heavily into cash. I think we got up to about 40% cash. The LEIs were rolling over. The recession index had crossed over 20, got up to 21. And it really did look that we were heading into recession. And I don't know if everybody can recall, but what happened, that was when the Fed came in and announced QE Infinity. They basically said, we're going to print $80 billion a month and we're going to do it. We're not going to give you an amount of which we'll stop, and we're not going to give you a time frame. And they did that all the way up to 2014. So if you want to take the Fed indicator with financial stress as kind of one major model, then the LEIs and the recession index, then what we use is we have a technical series of indicators that we look for corroboration and confirmation of what we're seeing on the economic and the financial front. And I mean, it's not bulletproof. I mean, a good example was 2011. You had the market breaking down. You had all four of our fundamental indicators, with the exception of the Fed, is all of them were flashing warning signs. The market corrected almost 20% during the summer, and inflation was heating up, all kinds of things that were happening. And yet, what the Fed did is the Fed was seeing this. The Fed came out and said, I guess QE1 and QE2 didn't work. We're going to go to QE infinity. We're not going to tell you an amount. We're not going to tell you when we're going to stop. And all of a sudden, the markets turned around, and we got double-digit gains in the market in 2012, 13, 14. We just about broke even in 15. And of course, we had a good year in 16 and a spectacular year in 17. So once again, these aren't bulletproof. And all we're really doing is we're hoping is to capture most of the upside if they're all telling us the market is heading up, and most importantly, to avoid the bulk of the downturn.
Now, what were these indicators telling you when we got that very sharp correction right at the beginning of the year? Because frankly, it took a lot of people by surprise.
You know what? The LEIs were moving up, and our recession indicator was moving down, indicating a pickup in economic growth. The monetary policy indicator was loose. There was no financial stress. There was no indication of widening credit spreads. And even a lot of the technicians said that, you know, other than the fact that the market had been overbought, overextended, PE ratios were high, we've had very few technicians that came on and said, you know what? I think we're headed for a correction. It's going to come. You know, there were a couple of people that made some calls like that, but not very many. So the important thing about what we're trying to emphasize here, and I think what Chris was trying to emphasize in his article, and by the way, if you do have a chance to go by the bookstore, I highly recommend you pick it up and read it, a worthwhile article. You need to have a system, as bear markets could be damaging to anyone's financial health. And the reason why, think of 2000, when the first bear market of this century began and lasted to 2002. The market lost close to 50% of its value. It would take another 5 years before the S&P got back to where it was in March of 2000. You get back even, What happens? From 2007 to 2009, the S&P lost 58%, and it would be to 2013 till you got back even again. So you want to avoid these major downdrafts. At the same time, you don't want to be completely out of the market. You want to take place in any kind of upswing as we've been in since March of 2009.
You know, we do know that a lot of investors got out after 2009 and then have only really very, very reluctantly come back in recently. And a lot of what this indicates is they're working without a philosophy, you know, and doing that is like driving blind without GPS to guide you as to where you're going.
You know, and what is driving that, John, is human emotion. You know, unfortunately, a lot of investors let their emotions get the best of them when they're making their investment decisions. And unfortunately, in this 24-hour news cycle that we live in today, whether social media, you're listening to it on television, the radio, podcast, whatever it is something happens and the media just drums the heck over and over and over. I mean, you can get 24 hours coverage of something. And what that does, it builds emotions either on fear or on greed. And the fear emotion is the most powerful. And that's when the media really drives it home. Gruesome images of any kind of event or something, and they just scare the bejesus out of you when something happens. And what happens is if you don't have a system or methodology, it's very easy to react to the financial press or the media and let that drive your emotions. You know, the unfortunate thing is the blow dries are always looking through the rearview mirror, and they're always going to over-dramatize anything that happens in the news.
How do political beliefs factor into this? Or maybe a better question is, how can your political beliefs cloud your investment philosophy? Because, you know, a lot of people were not fond of President Obama, but the markets did very well during his tenure as president. A lot of people aren't thrilled with President Trump, but the markets have done very well here as well.
That is a real dangerous thing to do, is to let your political beliefs drive your investment decisions. You know, I wasn't a big fan of Obama and some of his policies, but that didn't stop us from getting invested in the market. Actually, markets can do quite well under a Democratic president, and they usually do. Same likewise with Republicans, although Republicans tend to hold the presidency more often in recessions than Democrats do. But you can't let political beliefs or your emotions drive your decisions. You really have to have a model or a system that you use to make your investment decisions. That's the best way to navigate markets, whether we're in a bull market, bear market, or we're heading towards the top or heading towards the bottom.
What everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
When it comes to talking about industrial metals, all else being equal, it's ultimately Econ 101, an issue of supply versus demand. So the U.S. is the largest economy in the world. That shouldn't be a shock to everyone. It makes up about 25% of world GDP. So we're a major driver of demand for industrial health in other countries as well. We buy an immense amount of goods from countries from Southeast Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Europe. And so most of the world's industrial economies tend to follow us into recessionary periods. So that phase C slowing growth trend that we're expecting to take hold later this year, that's likely going to hold true for a majority of the world's countries as well. Aside from that, China is a huge player. They're the second largest economy in the world, but they're far and above the largest consumer of steel in the world. Orders of magnitude ahead of India, which is the second largest consumer. The majority of that goes to their relatively low-tech manufacturing base, which uses a lot of raw materials to make intermediate materials, and then their construction sector. Whenever you see a hit to either the manufacturing sector in China or the construction sector in China, you can say with pretty good certainty that commodity prices are going to take a hit as well.
Well, it's tax time this time of the year. On the day we're doing this interview, it is April 17th, the last day for filing. But 2018 is going to be a different year. A major tax bill has been put forth that could alter real estate in so many ways. Joining me on the program from Real Wealth Networks is Kathy Fetke. Kathy, let's talk about three provisions in the tax bill that have an impact on real estate. One was the limitation on home mortgage deduction to $750,000. I might want to point out that's on new mortgages. The old ones are grandfathered. That's number one. Number two, the limitation on property taxes to $10,000 and then elimination of the deductibility of state taxes. Let's begin in our own state of California, where Kathy, $750,000 is probably a starter home here in California.
That is true. And so it's been my opinion that this won't affect high-end real estate that much. This is just my personal opinion, and I'm not sure that the National Association of Realtors agrees with me. But in my opinion, and the people I've helped buy homes, they like the idea that there's tax deductions, but that's not generally why they buy the home. They want to be in a certain school district, or they want to live there for a long time and have ownership, not get kicked out if they're renters. They want to pay off their mortgage over time, rather than be a renter. So it's been my experience that at that end of the market, people are less affected by this change. And it really doesn't affect other states because most people, most houses are not even close to $750,000 in other normal places. So, again, that's my personal opinion. But with that said, I think we're still going to see an exodus of people moving out of California for many reasons.
You know, it's amazing because there was a study done recently on the number of states that are losing population. California was there, New York, New Jersey, several others. And you had destinations like Florida and Texas, Nevada, Arizona are now the recipients of this exodus. When you're talking with clients about relocating, what is the main reason they give you for leaving the state of California? Is it the traffic jams? Is it the cost of living? Is it the taxes or all of the above?
It's all of that. We have 10,000 people retiring every single day, or at least trying to, turning 65. And that will be the case for the next decade. So when people look at their situation and realize, wow, I didn't really save enough for retirement, considering, people are living longer, and in general, we're seeing inflation. So people have an opportunity right now to sell their property at the peak of the market and move somewhere else. And I see it across the board. Our own director of properties moved from California to Florida for the exact reasons you just said. He could sell his okay house. It was, middle-class house just outside of San Francisco in not a great school district. He sold that for about $800,000, moved to a really high-end part of Florida, paid about half that for a home in a very good school district, and no state income taxes. He's a young guy. He's in his 40s and just raising a family. But look at people who are in their 60s. Their kids have moved out. They can finally go anywhere. And they have this amazing opportunity to cash in and trade down, basically trade up, but for a lower price. They could move to a nicer neighborhood, pay less in taxes and less overall expenses, and just live a similar lifestyle. I mean, Texas and Florida are the two areas where most people are moving to today. Nevada would be on that list, too. Those are all states with no state income tax. So that tells you something, plus a ton of affordability. Now, they do get kind of hot in the summer, right? Uncomfortable. But for all the money that you're saving, gosh, they can go on a cruise, they can go travel during those months and still come out way ahead.
Yeah, you can take vacations on what you're not paying in income taxes. Do you find that this is a broad spectrum? Because I know even in our own practice, Kathy, when we're dealing with individuals here in California who are considering retiring a couple of years from retiring, I would say about 20% of them are thinking about relocating to someplace cheaper. Arizona, Nevada, as you mentioned, or even Texas or Florida are places where you can get, you know, a nicer house and be in a better neighborhood for sometimes 50% of what you're selling your house for here in California, not to mention lower taxes, property taxes and income taxes, or in the case of Nevada and Texas or Florida, no taxes.
That's right. Now, the difference is there are people who bought property in California a long time ago, and they have paid off their mortgage or they've paid it down, and they are locked into pretty low property tax rates, you know, because they don't go up that much in California thanks to our laws right now. Those laws could always change. But if somebody has hit retirement and they bought their house 30 years ago and they have it paid off and they're locked into a low property tax rate, they're not going anywhere. And that's kind of the problem. You know, that California, at least the places people want to live, San Francisco, let's focus on that, there's not a whole lot of room to build, right? It's already built out. So if people who've lived there a long time aren't moving, well, that's just going to drive up the price of properties for people who would like to start their families. So I think that's really what we're going to see is there's really a split. It's people who are forming families. I mean, how can they possibly make it work in California, and not all parts of California, but in the expensive parts? Some of the young people I'm talking to are moving into less desirable areas just to be able to get into property. And I wonder if that's the best thing to do. If it's regentrifying, that's one thing. But if you're just so desperate to own property in California that you're going to move into a really low income area with terrible schools, you know, is that really the choice you want to make? And a lot of people are saying, no, I'm going to move to Texas where the schools are great and where I can live comfortably and raise my family.
You know, something that we've seen in this cycle, and I wonder if you might comment on, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about, you know, builder sentiment, which is pretty high. And that is, you know, homes have been appreciating about 6% a year. I think it's 6% over last year. And they talked about a couple of things that we are lacking, which is driving up prices. Number one is inventory. There's just not enough homes to meet demand. And number two, you talk to the builders, they don't have enough workers. I wonder how much of an impact has this had on real estate prices? And according to the journal, this is likely to be the case for at least another year or two.
Or more. I mean, you know, the biggest result or the impact we're seeing right now are these tariffs. The tariffs on the building supplies in a market where it's already 30% higher costs for builders to try to get anything done. Most of the increase in cost has come from increased regulation. And that is exactly what we don't need. We don't need more regulation, certainly not in California, unless California just really wants people to go away. I mean, that's what they're basically creating. Maybe they just don't want more traffic and they don't want people to live here. And only those who are, you know, just can't live anywhere else will stay. But, you know, every time we get to this place, and it is not the first time, I'm born and raised in California, and it has always been an expensive place to live. Even when my father bought a $99,000 house in Atherton, one of the most expensive suburbs in the whole state, it was $99,000 back then in the 70s. Even then, that was considered expensive. So, you know, it's not a new problem. But when we get here, where the average person can't afford to buy, that seems to be when city planners make it even more difficult. they add all these extra regulations that make it less enticing for builders to build because it's just cost prohibitive. And all they can bring in today is higher end, and that's why we're seeing kind of a slowdown, at least in high-end condos in San Francisco and L.A., because that's pretty much what builders have been focused on, is high-end product that maybe there's just not enough buyers out there for it.
Kathy, has anybody within government or is the real estate industry approached government itself and say, look, you know, the governor is talking about housing shortages and making them realize that these regulations they're putting in place. I know when I built my own house, it took almost a year to get it through the planning process. You know, you can't spend a year in red tape if you want to get rid of a housing shortage. In fact, on the news this week in L.A., they're talking about giving vouchers to put homeless people in people's backyards in L.A.
Yeah, again, that's one of the reasons that you'll see more people leaving California. Again, I don't think it's because of the change in the mortgage deduction. I think it's just everything else. You know, we have a government that is wanting more and more to control our lives. And, you know, when people get tired of it, they pick up and move to places like Florida and Texas that seem to have more respect for the individual's choice. And so it is a challenging time to be in California, and I don't know that the city planners care. I think that they would prefer that people leave, and that's exactly what they're doing. Now, the good news is that there are options. There's wonderful places to live in the U.S., and people are discovering that. I mean, we help, you know, our members at Real Wealth Network discover that there are some really fantastic cities that are kind of under the radar. You know, Atlanta's booming, and it's still somewhat affordable. And all of Florida is booming because of nice weather, and it's still cheap, and there's great medical facilities. Even Cleveland, that used to be called the Mistake on the Lake, has had a complete renovation and revitalization, and has become a pretty cool place to live. I went to one of my favorite restaurants that was gluten-free and all organic in Cleveland, of all places, where I could never find anything but fries and a burger, you know, just 10 years ago.
So do you see this as Meredith Whitney, an analyst, wrote a book on the state of the states, and she talked about in the next decade, we're more likely to see an inward migration. In other words, those expensive areas of the country on the East Coast and the West Coast, like California, as you just mentioned, people are just packing up and leaving for various reasons, taxes, traffic jams, regulations, you know, just the cost of living. They're moving to places where they don't have to deal with that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just especially as more and more people hit retirement age and they don't maybe need to be where they've been living, they can go. Now, I'm one of those people that will probably never leave because I live next to the ocean. I like to surf. There's hiking trails everywhere. But I got to tell you, I'm oftentimes the only person out there, the only person on those trails or, you know, in the water. So maybe some of the amenities that I love are not that interesting to other people. So, you know, it's just kind of a thought. Like, when people go out and see what is there, again, towns like Austin, it's a very cute town, and there's lots to do. There's music, great restaurants. Like I said, in the summer, it can get real hot, but hey, go on your vacation then. Go somewhere else because you can afford to do it. So, yes, I think that that's why we help so many people buy investment property in some of these growing metro areas that, you know, the world just doesn't quite know are revitalizing and becoming pretty nice places to live.
You know, it's amazing because if we take a look at retirement, and as you mentioned, 10,000 boomers retiring every single day, a lot of these boomers, Kathy, didn't have the assets they thought they were going to have when they retired because we've had two major bear markets at the beginning of the decade and then, of course, the Great Recession. So the assets they thought they were going to have just simply aren't there. And the second thing is that interest rates are at historical lows, even though we're talking about a 4.5% mortgage. I can remember, you know, a number of years ago, 4.5% mortgage would have been a bargain. So what they're doing, as you just mentioned, is, well, what can I do? If I don't have the assets and interest rates aren't about to change dramatically, what I can do is alter where I live. And so relocation is becoming a major aspect and tool used in at least retirement planning today. As I mentioned, about 20% of our California clients are choosing to leave the state.
Yeah, and that's, I think, I'm amazed sometimes that I believe there's $23 or $24 trillion tied up in the stock market. And that's a lot of money that people have their funds tied up. And a lot of those people don't really understand the fundamentals and don't understand the market cycle. There's ups and there's downs. The last thing you want is a down when you're retiring. If you're obviously holding for the long term, you can, you know, it seems to come back. But to have all your assets tied into something that could be volatile, or at least, you know, they need to have the right financial planner to make sure they're in the right stocks that make sense and where the fundamentals are in place. But most people don't have a clue about that. And I don't know, you're an expert in that side of it, but it seems like many financial planners are more concerned about their what's in it for them than what's in it for the client. So I'm happy to see that more and more people are becoming aware and realizing that they do have a lot of equity in homes that they can cash in on now and go do something else and secure their retirement, because it's been something that we haven't thought about, trying to raise your kids and get them to college. And one day you wake up and say, oh, my goodness, I forgot about me. I better figure out how I'm going to live for the rest of my life. And there are opportunities to cash in today to be able to do that.
Do you find there are particular areas that really stand out in terms of housing values, let's say lifestyle, cost of living, all those kind of things? You mentioned earlier that a lot of people are going to Texas, Florida, Nevada. The commonality between those three are no state income taxes. Is there one state or one area that really stands out to you in terms of the values that you can get, the culture, the lifestyle? Because moving to a place involves several things, you know, especially if you're a senior. You want good medical care, access to education, nice restaurants, golf courses, things like that. Is there anything that stands out to you?
Well, just a demographic chart. We're seeing most people moving to Texas and Florida, then Nevada. You have a lot of Californians moving to Portland and Seattle and, you know, basically Oregon and Washington, although those areas are not cheap anymore, but they're cheaper than California. And I think a lot of times people move to those areas and realize, wow, this is not even close to the same weather. It rains a lot up there, and it's a rainforest, basically, in Seattle. And if you're a California blue sky person, that's be a hard transition. So that's why we're starting to see more people discover Texas and Florida, which maybe just 10 years ago were not, how do I say it, up to our standards of what we expect for lifestyle. But that has changed. And now, like I said, there are some wonderful restaurants in those areas. There's lots to do, great shopping, great schools. Obviously, in Florida, lots of beaches. It's still not the kind of climate that we enjoy in California, but it's pretty close. And now we're actually helping people diversify even out of the country for those who are concerned about the massive debt issues that we have here and just some of the politics. We're actually building a community in Costa Rica that has nearly sold out because the climate there is really nice and it's still an affordable place. But, you know, not everybody wants to move out of the country. So those would be the standout places for Californians. But for a good investment, and of course, that's the way I look at real estate is as an investment, I think we're going to see a massive transition into the Midwest because we have two really serious issues coming up that this world is going to have to deal with. And that is that we're running out of water and we're running out of food and we're running out of oil. I know it doesn't seem like it today, but, you know, fast forward 20 years, these are going to be major issues. And that's going to make farmland really, really valuable. And so that's why we're helping investors kind of get into those areas we can cash flow today, but then in the future may be very, very valuable because growing food is going to be, it's going to be gold. And in Ohio, this is one of the places we're helping people buy. Ohio, I don't know if you know this, but they have the cleanest water and they have a lot of water in their underground system. And that's going to become very, very valuable in the future.
You know, it's interesting you bring those up because I just read a book on mega trends and several of them were the ones you just mentioned. The possible shortage of food, the depletion of energy, which could run out or at least run out in terms of peak production in the next decade. And then, of course, water is something which we're dealing here in California. We're always in and out of drought conditions.
It's a concern that nobody wants to talk about, and we still live abundantly, not wanting to look at reality. I mean, even when California had a massive drought, I couldn't get my daughter out of the shower. You're wasting water. But we don't want to face the reality of that. We've never really had to. But then you look at a place like South Africa that has just gone through it, like they literally ran out of water. That'll affect real estate. You know, if people can't live somewhere, that's going to affect things. And I think that's why city planners are difficult, because There's a lot of city planners who are all about slow growth because they don't want more traffic and they don't want more people using their local resources. And that's understandable. It doesn't help with housing costs. But, you know, this, again, is going to be something people need to think about over the next decade. And some of the areas that we've kind of poo-pooed, so to speak, are going to become very valuable, and it's the farmlands of America.
You know, this is interesting because, you know, we've been talking about taxes, traffic jams, regulations, all those kind of things that go into making that retirement situation. But you just brought out something that nobody's really thinking about is the scarcity of food, water, and energy that we will be looking at and facing in the next decade, which is something people aren't really thinking of right now.
Well, I tell you what, I follow some thought leaders like Chris Martinson, Adam Taggart, Simon Black. I just spent a week on a cruise ship with them, and it was very depressing because they are looking at these topics. And so it's one of the reasons that we bought 800 acres with our investment group, and we bought 800 acres in Costa Rica, which is extremely fertile ground. And we planted 10,000 fruit trees and avocados and coconut trees. And because of this issue, we believe that's going to be more valuable than anything in the future. And just here in Malibu, there's a couple of lots in our neighborhood that are as cheap as $99,000. I know that sounds crazy in California, but they're kind of hard to build on, and it would take 10 years to get permits to build. But we just started buying those up, and we're just planting trees, fruit trees, just to prepare for what people don't want to face. Now, we do have the water issues here, so it's not as easy to grow food in California versus Costa Rica, where it rains almost every day. But the interesting thing about where I live in Malibu is the fog comes in every night and kind of waters the plants where we live. So again, I know it does sound alarmist, but you know, if you do have a little bit of land, it might be a good time to just start practicing how to grow things so that if you ever really need to have those skills, you would have it. Or like I said, you know, consider investing in properties that do have land. And like I said, Ohio, we've got a lot of investors buying property there that they're renting out and they're just cash flowing on, but they will have land they can grow stuff on in the future if they need to.
You know, this is amazing when you talk about land or simply growing things. It almost goes back over a century ago, Kathy, when, you know, the average American did that. They had gardens, they lived on farms, and we become so industrialized, automated, high tech that we forget some of the basic necessities. And that's what I think we're going to be facing in the next decade, is shortages of food, water, and energy are going to drive the cost of everything up.
Yes. And, you know, there's some really neat developments and technologies that I think more important than ever to learn. And I'm just learning it. I'm no expert by any means. I can barely grow a tomato plant at this point. But you see these rooftop gardens, and next door to me, there's a house that made the whole side of their house a garden that could just grow off. I don't know if you've seen those little pots that hang on the side of your house. And they don't need a lot of water. They just need a little drip system. You can even put in a gray water situation where your sinks and certain things will go into your plant. So, you know, there's ways to preserve this resource. I mean, you're even seeing now buckets. People put out buckets, so, you know, the chain from the roof, and they have buckets underneath, and they use the rain for watering their plants. So I think there's going to be a lot of new technologies, and we're going to have to learn how to use those. A wonderful resource that doesn't seem to be picking up much speed right now would be to figure out how to use the ocean water and desalinate that. I know that there's been some effort in that and hasn't gone well yet, but boy, wouldn't that be a solution?
Well, we just built our first one here in San Diego, where we desperately need the water, because in California, as you know, the water is up north. Kathy, as you look at these places along this theme of food, water, and energy, how does Texas, Florida, and Nevada stand up? Texas has plenty of energy.
You nailed it. Texans and many of the middle states, the mid-states, midwestern states, those are people who still know how to work. Now, the coastal markets, and I'm guilty of this too, we just know how to trade paper, right? It's a lot of white-collar workers. And so when you get to the Midwest and Texas, you still see cattle farms, regular farms. You've got energy, oil and gas. You know, same with North Dakota. You can't grow anything because it's winter half the time, but lots of oil up there. So from what I heard at this last seminar, oil is going to have a major comeback because we stopped producing. And, you know, fast forward a few years, energy prices are going to increase. And so that will only make Texas more valuable. and North Dakota as well, and Ohio and Pennsylvania, all these areas like Oklahoma, where they know how to produce. Most Americans don't know how to produce anymore, and that's what Trump has been talking about. Let's get workers back to work. And so those, again, those Midwestern towns, I really think are going to be the ones thriving in the years to come.
Well, Kathy, as we close, if our listeners would like to hear more about the kind of work that you do, you help investors and you help individuals relocate, tell them how they could do so, please.
Oh, sure. Our website is realwealthnetwork.com, realwealthnetwork.com. And I do free webinars every week. There's a blog every day. I mean, we're just on a mission to educate people as to their options, whether it's buying your first house with a 3% down mortgage, like we helped our daughter do, whether it's, you know, getting into 1-4 units with an FHA loan, again, with just 3% down so that you can become an investor, or to be able to buy property in a place like Detroit. We have a tour coming up to show people that they could buy a property for $60,000 and rent it out for about $900 a month. We really think we're going to see values go up there because that's an area that is absolutely regentrifying. It's suffering from a bad reputation, but if you go there, you'll see there's lots of transition happening. So realwealthnetwork.com, it's free to join, and you'll get lots of resources there.
Kathy, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. And summing up, as we look at high-end real estate, according to the people you deal with, this change in the tax laws is probably not going to affect that very much at all.
I just don't think so. I mean, anyone buying at that price point isn't going to be that affected by a $250 a month difference or $250 a year difference, whatever it is. They didn't buy for those reasons. They just maybe have to cut back on their gardener or whatever. Yeah, I don't think they'll be as strapped. It's the people who were really already stressed out with affordability. They will be affected.
Well, listen, Kathy, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. All the best to you, and come back again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Interesting conversation about real estate with Kathy. We were talking about trends that we're seeing, migration out of heavy taxed, heavy congested states like California to places like Texas, Florida, and Nevada. What was interesting is she brought up about food, water, and oil, because I'm reading several books about this shortage that we're likely to face in the next decade. So in addition to moving for cost of living, lower taxes, medical care, maybe a nicer place to live, food, energy, and water is going to be also important in the next decade.
Coming up in the weeks ahead, Jim, what are we looking for?
Oh, let me see. We're still in the middle of corporate earnings season, so we're going to be looking at that. We also have a lot of economic indicators coming out. All of them right now, basically the LAIs are saying that we should strengthen in the second quarter. Now, the other thing we're watching is volatility leading to widening credit spreads. So that will be one of the first things on our radar screen that we're going to be watching. Right now, the markets are pricing in a higher probability of a fourth rate hike. We know it's unlikely in May, very probable in June. Will they go in September, and will they go in December? Right now, the markets are saying 40% odds that they're more likely to go in September and December. In other words, 4 rate hikes. And that could be a little bit of the nervousness that you're seeing with the markets right now, with the 10-year yield jumping over 2.9% as the markets anticipate more inflation. And what does that mean? More rate hikes. Well, that concludes this week's program. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.